From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is a Memorial Day edition of Radio Boston. This hour, some of our favorite segments to honor people and things we miss. From a heroic and tragic attempted sea rescue where veterans went out to help during the storm of the century.
What a great way to live your life when other people step back because of fear. You're going to try to do the right thing and be helpful.
To missing live music at Club Passim and art at the ICA.
I hope that it's a piece that people return to over and over again over the decades, and it becomes a touchstone for an experience.
Nubian Square's Haley House and that famous Prince Spaghetti ad.
I miss those days. Sunday afternoons, my brothers, my sister. So every weekend, the whole family, it was a family gathering.
It's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for joining us for this special Memorial Day edition of the show, a day when we take the time to honor and remember those who died in service to our country. And right now, it is also a time to reflect on what we're blessed to still have, while treasuring the things we truly miss. Because as we're headed toward a new normal for almost everyone, that means handling a great deal of loss, of moving forward without the things and the people we miss so much. That's our focus for this hour. We begin at sea with the heroic, tragic story of the men aboard Gloucester's pilot boat, the Can Do. More than 42 years ago, on February 6, 1978, off the coast of Salem, a 600-plus-foot oil tanker, the Global Hope, was dragging anchor right as a massive storm slammed New England, a blizzard that would later be known as the Blizzard of 1978, a once-in-a-century storm. The ship radioed shore, saying they were taking on water, and the lives of 33 crew on board were at risk. The U.S. Coast Guard sprung into action, dispatching rescue boats, a 44 and a 95-footer, from Gloucester and Boston. Both of those ships struggled to make progress, and the 44-footer lost radar and their ability to see in the 40-foot seas and blinding snow.
We're off the station 31 seconds. We have visibility is probably 30 feet. We have nothing in sight at this time. Over.
That's Frank Quirk Jr. of Gloucester, the captain of the Can Do. He was listening to the Coast Guard radio communications and could not sit idly by. He called in his crew, and they took to the raging waters to see if they could be of service to their friends in the Coast Guard. But they thought this was a run-of-the-mill New England storm, and it quickly became clear that it was not.
That was Charlie Bucco on the Can Do. Charlie was a former Coast Guard man helping Frank Quirk during this attempted rescue. He was the one who said, "Mayday, mayday, mayday, this is not a drill, this is not a drill."
That's Michael Togas, author of Into the Blizzard, Heroism at Sea During the Great Blizzard of 1978. Togas tells the story of how the Can Do went out to rescue others and got lost in the waves.
Charlie says, "We're trying to get into deeper water here." Station Gloucester goes, "Keep talking." And Charlie goes, "We're in shoal water. Our windshield is out. Position unknown. Action extremely violent." The last message began to explain what happened to the Can Do. It had hit a shoal or shallow water, either the ocean's bottom or a rock ledge. At the same moment, the windshield was blown out, probably from a giant wave. The wall of water, parts of the windshield, and the motor from the spinning window crashed into Frank's head, knocking him from the wheel.
It's the story Togas tells in his recent adaptation for young readers of his best-selling book, 10 Hours Until Dawn.
A lot of times people go, "What the heck were they doing out in the blizzard of 78? I always say, well, first, they didn't know this was going to turn into the storm of the century. It was exploding upon them at the time. And second, they had a lot of experience in just the year before in an eerily similar situation in a blizzard when an oil tanker split in half. They were able to save 6 out of 7 men on board.
I want to go back and emphasize something you just said, which is we now know what the blizzard of 1978 was. But as it was emerging, people didn't. They didn't have any idea of the disaster that was barreling down on them. What made this storm so deadly and so particular, as you said, a storm of the century?
The main issue was it stalled in place, and the height of waves is a formation of wind speed, the open fetch of the ocean, and the duration of the wind. The winds were coming out of the northeast, so as they left Gloucester to head down towards Salem Sound, which is where this oil tanker was last seen, they'd be going with these giant seas. So if you could imagine the seas pushing them along on the stern. And when the Can-Do lost its radar, they turned back towards Gloucester, but now they're going into these giant waves, which have grown to approximately 40 feet. And our theory, the captain's son and I, we both think that while the men on the Can-Do think they're heading back north to Gloucester, the waves are actually pushing them backwards, even with engine power running.
You know, when you write about the men on the Can-Do, there's a sense of awe in the way that you talk about them, especially Frank Quirk. Tell us a little bit about Frank Quirk in your eyes.
I think a lot of my respect for Frank came with the way he handled himself, both in rescues before the blizzard and in non-rescues. For example, if somebody ran out of gas out on the ocean, Frank, it might be his day off, and he'd be the one to go out there, give the person gas. They'd say, "What do we owe you?" He'd say, "Nothing, maybe throw me a fish next time." And then during the storm, I gained all new respect, because on the radio, he's even tempered, even when he knows the chances aren't good that they're going to make it. You never hear panic in his voice. You never hear shouting. He's giving as much information as he can to the Coast Guard in hopes that they'll locate him with these bigger cutters.
Charlie sounds different than the way that you described Frank when he says, "Mayday, mayday, this is not a drill." What would one expect of a human being in those moments?
Knowing that they lost their windshield as they did, Charlie's got a shout to be heard above the wind and the seas. Charlie, I came away with such respect as well, and I often thought he's one of the most charismatic people I've ever researched and written about. He had two Purple Hearts from Vietnam. He just came back. He got a brand new coat. He goes by a homeless guy, and he goes, "He needs this more than I do," and off goes the brand new coat rather than give the guy $5. He was serving in the Coast Guard just prior to the blizzard. As I mentioned, that rescue a year earlier was the oil tanker Chester Poling. It was a very dangerous rescue Charlie was involved in, and he said to his fiancée, Sharon, "I don't want to make you a widow. We're planning to have a family, so I'm going to leave the Coast Guard," which he did. But when he got the call from Frank, of course, he couldn't say no. The men on the 44 were men that Charlie had trained. Of course, he was going to give it a try.
What happened to the boat?
The boat was off of the Gooseberry Islands, which would be south of Baker's Island, off of Salem. After that May Day, it lost engine power later in the night, and then all communication was lost. And then surprisingly, a private radio operator came on the air, and he said, "I can still hear Frank." But eventually, the seas were too much. We know, because later the boat was found, we know that it rolled along the bottom of the ocean.
And there were no survivors.
There were no survivors. There was hope about finding Charlie alive because he was not found with the others in the first few days after the blizzard.
You wrote this version of this story for young adults. What do you want young adults to learn from it? What do you want them to take from it?
Well, the first thing is getting kids to read again. But then I also want them to learn from these, I guess we could call them heroes. They're flawed people. They're not superheroes. They're afraid, just like you and I might be, but somehow, where I might be incapacitated by my fear, these people know how to keep it in check and still do the job. And they just kind of focus these people that get through the impossible. And oftentimes, even if they don't think they're going to make it, they have a mindset, and one of them verbalized this to me, who did survive. He said, I thought I was going to die, but I'm going to go down fighting.
This is a story of heroism, but it is also a gut-wrenching, heartbreaking tragedy. We discover in the end that the tanker really wasn't in distress, and no one needed to go out.
Isn't that ironic that they started it all? They were only in 20 feet of water on Coney Island Ledge, where their stern was pushed to. And the first person that was helicoptered down, you know, he rappelled down to it, Barry Chambers, he was with the Atlantic Strike Team. He said, I was just furious at the captain because I had followed all this. And then to go on and see that all 33 men on board were absolutely fine. The vessel was in no danger of breaking apart. He said, my disgust was made quite evident to that captain.
You could have written this story as a tragedy. You didn't. I would argue you wrote it as a triumph. Did you do that because that's what we need today? Or did you do that because that's the way you tell a story like this to young adults? Or was there some other reason you focused on the triumph even in this maddening tragedy?
I think it came back to Frank's words on that initial time where I listened to the first time I listened to the audio tape and pulled my car over on 128 to keep listening. He said early on to the Coast Guard, okay, we're going to give it our best shot. And I just think that was the way he looked at it. He couldn't sit there, that he had to give it his best shot. And that, you know, when I talked to his son and his daughter about that, they said, yeah, that was a line my dad used. And I thought, what a great way to live your life. When other people step back because of fear, you're going to try to do the right thing and be helpful.
A perfect message for us now in the midst of the coronavirus crisis. Michael Togas is the author of numerous books, including The Finest Hours, A Storm Too Soon, and 10 Hours Until Dawn. We spoke with him earlier this year about his latest, an adaptation for young readers of 10 Hours, titled Into the Blizzard. Stay with us. There's more ahead on this Memorial Day edition of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. Welcome back to this Memorial Day edition of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. This hour, we're revisiting some recent conversations about the people, places, and things we're missing during this crisis. In November of last year, we marked a milestone for the revival of folk music, the 60th anniversary of Harvard Square's Club Passim. And while Passim is temporarily closed during the pandemic, the club has been a hub in the folk music scene, not only for the Boston area, but for the country for decades. We spoke with Betsy Siggins, former executive director of Club Passim and founding member of Club Passim's predecessor, Club 47, and Matt Smith, current managing director of Club Passim. And Siggins began with what Club 47 and Passim were like back in the late 50s and early 60s.
It was singularly wonderful. Without knowing where we were going, there was no roadmap. Joan Baez began singing at Club 47 back in the late 50s, early 60s, and attracted an enormous amount of interest in her music, her voice, and her presence. I was a waitress in a bunch of coffee houses, and I got attracted to Club 47, which was really just beginning. It seemed like it was just like combustion. Artists from around the community began playing there. It just felt like it was the right time, the right place for the beginning of the folk revival.
Okay, we got to hear some music. So we happen to have some Joan Baez. This is Diamonds and Rust.
Well, I'll be damned. Here comes your ghost again. But that's not unusual. It's just that the moon is full.
So Matt, she's a legend. And we're hearing so much about the opening years and the magic of that time. What's it like now, and where are you drawing magic from now?
I think that the folk music scene now is probably as robust as it's ever been. You know, the revival of the 60s was kind of its first burst of energy coming back, and now we are experiencing a new take on it where there are kids that have started growing up in the fiddle camp world and the, you know, the song camp world. And so they're starting from a very young age, but then also with the music schools around the Boston area, they have strong folk music and roots music departments. And so you really end up with people that are kind of indoctrinated into this early on, and are, some of them are masters of their instruments by the time they even reach the college age.
You can imagine we had a blast preparing for this segment. We had songs galore, all kinds of music, because who wouldn't when we're doing this? And we walked through the history of folk a little bit. I want to grab a little beginning of the journey. This is the Jim Queskin Jug Band. It's a bit from their version of Blues My Naughty Sweetie Gives to Me.
That's good for pain. And there are blues when you are lonely, for your one and only, the blues you can never explain.
Okay, so first, there's a jug in there, and lots of other instruments. So in the early days of folk, and as folk emerged, there was such great variation, both in sound, instruments, voice. What allowed for all those different kinds of sounds to come in and form this important music, Betsy?
Well, you know, many of those people came to the Boston community already being some kind of a musician. Jim Queskin brought all of that history about jug bands. And just to put a point on it, Fritz Richmond's jug, it now lives in the Smithsonian Institution.
Really?
Yeah.
That's really cool.
So that does go back a bit. I don't know. I think that like many places, you find your heart. You find a community, you find camaraderie. In our case, we also found protest. And the 60s were, you know, rife with protests. And it was really important for all of us to be able to connect music and social justice. And Joan was, of course, the person who led us through that and opened our eyes to what was going on in America.
Let's listen, before I turn to Matt for more, let's listen to Josh Ritter. This is Girl in the War.
I got a girl in the war, Paul, the only thing I know to do. Turn up the music and pray that she makes it through.
Matt, the everyday person, the working person, served in Vietnam. They fought in our wars, and that was one of the big focuses of protest in the 1960s and 70s. Protest for the working person is different today. We often hear about protest about socioeconomic standing, the loss of jobs. Is folk music still reflecting the lived experience of the everyday person in America?
I think it is. It's different than kind of a lot of the boots on the ground protests and marches that have happened before, although we certainly have seen a lot of that in the past few years. There are different social struggles now than there were back in the 60s. And I think that music is an important part of them, but it's taken a different route. There are many different kinds of music that are engaging in this kind of social protest now. Folk music is absolutely part of it, but, you know, rap music is part of it, and rock music is part of it, and you know there are many different ways that people engage, and it's not just feet on the ground, you know, marching. There are social media protests that happen, and we can look at that as sort of a little bit more frivolous, as people, you know, sit on their couch and protest with their phone. But there are elements of that that speak to the everyday person as well.
Betsy, you've had a firsthand front row seat in the history of how music has evolved in America. How does music help us tell people who we are and what we're experiencing?
It brings you into a new community that you don't have to play to speak your mind. You can be a listener, you can be a lover, you can be angry, you can be happy, you can be anything you want to be. With music, it's easier to spread the word.
Matt, what would you add to that?
At the end of the day, you know, the musician, the songwriter, is telling the story of not just themselves, but of everyone. You know, the best songs are ones that phrase things that you've always thought in a way that you weren't able to express.
All right, let's listen to some new music. This is Lula Wiles from their song, Mama.
Mama, I need to come home. I've been starving myself to bone. I've been up all night crying. I've been drinking alone. Mama, I need to come home.
Betsy, what are you excited about in the next phase for folk music?
Well, I'm about to start my memoirs, which I've talked about for 30 years, so it's nothing new. It's just trying to get it organized now. I just see the continuation of how music is important and how people who I don't know, people who I know may not have had a place to hang their own hat have learned through music that there's a place for them, and that we're working on my memoirs and looking back on what kind of communications we had. You know, we had telephones, and that's how somebody would call you from the Deep South. It didn't happen over...
What, a phone?
A phone. The transference of music from the old days to the newer ways of hearing it immediately, it's very, very exciting, and there's much more of it than there used to be.
Betsy Siggins, former executive director of Club Passim and founding member of Club Passim's predecessor, Club 47. And Matt Smith, current managing director of Passim, speaking with us back in November. So, live music venues like Passim, add them to our miss list. Also on that list, art exhibits and museums like the Institute of Contemporary Art.
落類の巨匠に住みて、やがて人の世の終末に。That's
the voice of contemporary artist Yayoi Kusama reciting her poetry outside her piece Love is Calling at the ICA. At 91 years old, Kusama is the world's most expensive living female artist. She has had a profound impact on contemporary art. The ICA has her piece Love is Calling, the largest of her infinity mirror rooms. We went there last fall and toured the exhibit with ICA director Jill Medvedow.
All of her work is about this seeking and her expression of oneness. You know, she talks a lot about self-obliteration. That's the term she uses. It was even the title of her film. For Kusama, self-obliteration is about the blurring of the edges from one polka dot to many polka dots, from one soul to many souls, from an individuality to a oneness with the cosmos. So it's back to this idea of connectivity and change through love.
Her passion for polka dots is inescapable. They're everywhere. Big black dots covering neon-colored, blow-up tentacle-like shapes that jut up from the floor and hang down from the ceiling. They don't smother you, but they are everywhere. So is the sense of the infinite, another of her core themes. It's a cube, but it's covered in mirrors, floor to ceiling. If you stand in just the right place, you, the tentacles, the polka dots, all of it goes on forever. You are obliterated. Infinity rooms were one way Kusama pushed her artwork into new territory. This boldness runs through much of the art she produced from the 1950s onwards, like her floor-to-ceiling net paintings, her protruding soft sculptures, and in her performance art, known as happenings. Here's Medvedow.
I think about how brave that era was and how brave she was, and that kind of agitprop and that we see on the streets today, right? As people gather to protest, you know, the bravery of bringing yourself and being naked and having your participants naked and painting one another with polka dots as a protest for the war. Incredibly brave.
Kusama moved to the United States from Japan when she was 27 years old. She ended up in New York in the late 1950s. At the time, abstract expressionism was everywhere, and at the center, artists like Jackson Pollock, William de Kooning, Franz Kline. As a Japanese woman, Kusama and her work stood out. Medvedow refers to her as a double outsider, as a woman and a woman of color working in that art world at that time.
She had studied traditional Japanese painting in Japan, and she came to the United States to really find her way as an avant-garde artist, something that wasn't supported back in Japan. for her as a woman and as somebody breaking with tradition.
There is some talk that her work, her innovations were really co-opted by better-known male artists like an Andy Warhol. Was that a common experience for female artists of that time?
I'm not sure that I could speak so broadly about co-opting with a kind of broad swath of female artists. But I think it was very, very difficult to be a female artist. Their place in the systems that convey value, the gallery system and collectors, etc., men have always prevailed and still do today. With Kusama in particular, being really early on with things like soft sculptures, which we later see with Klaus Oldenburg, or the pop culture imagery on wallpaper, which we, you know, see later with Warhol, as you're saying, and yet we know that they got the accolades.
And she definitely did both of those things before them.
She did do both of those things before them. How much is in the air and in the zeitgeist? That I don't know that I could say. I don't believe I've done enough research to actually know that. So I think that what we do know for sure is that being a woman artist in the 50s and 60s across the board was a very difficult road to hoe.
So by 1976, she's somewhat defeated. She goes back to Japan. She's largely been erased from sort of the understanding and the picture of art in the United States. And she winds up entering a psychiatric facility. And from there, somewhere, things turn. And people begin to appreciate the innovation of her work, the importance of her work. How do you think that happened?
I think she turned her attention to things other than the market. She wrote poetry, she wrote a novel, she made films. So she was very active. I would not say she was defeated. I think that clearly she left New York and went back to Japan and has chosen to live in a kind of protected environment is maybe how I would put it, and have a studio where she can work to this very day. She is looking forward.
In the documentary Infinity, she says that her goal is to create a new history of art in the USA. Do you think she succeeded in doing that?
Yes, I do think she succeeded in doing that. And as we've been discussing, she's finally getting the credit for doing it that she has deserved for almost 60 years now, right? Yes, she was defining.
You are at the ICA committed to bringing in artists of color. She experienced racism and sexism as a Japanese woman when she came to the U.S. art community. There has been criticism over time that she's been guilty of expressing some racist sentiments. And in an autobiography she wrote, bringing up stereotypes and tropes about Black people in America. Did you think about that? Did you struggle with that at all as you were thinking about bringing Kusama's art to the ICA?
What we really thought about is that the art, that Kusama herself is an incredibly complex person living in another culture. And, you know, she was born in 1929. So I think that trying to understand her in context is important. Trying to understand her overriding ideas and philosophies and her own experiences, I think we're poised to be able to present her for all of the things that she's earned and is worthy of. We're not trying to present her or anybody as a perfect person.
As we go into the exhibit, it's called Love is Calling. If you were personally going to guide somebody through that experience, what is one way you would suggest that they try to connect with this experience of love?
I would suggest that a person, when the door closes behind you, to actually feel what it's like to be living really in the mind of an extraordinary artist who has created this opportunity to peer into infinite space. We've just entered our fourth floor, our galleries, and we have hit this bright, shocking pink Hot Lips color of paint at the beginning to our infinity room, Love is Calling.
The only thing in the room is a bright white cube. It's the size of a small condo,
560 square feet.
Shall we go in?
Let's go in. We're
going to
walk
you
up
lead.
A ramp.
And as we enter the room, it's incredibly noisy. There's the poem again, and the constant hum of fans blowing air into the neon tentacles.
So now we're inside. You can hear behind me the sound of Kusama's voice reciting the poem. It is like, I don't know, I think it's a little bit like a, almost like a garden of kaleidoscopic stalactites and stalagmites. You see these yellow, blue, purple, pink inflatable sculptures. They're reflected all around you, so everywhere you look, you just see them.
The walls, at one moment it feels like the mirrored wall in front of me is very close. The next minute, it looks like it's very far away. It's hard to get a sense for the size and the shape
yes.
of the room.
It's a little disorienting, not in a scary way, but in a sense of you have to look around. Everything is mirrored. You know, you kind of want to look at yourself because there you are everywhere.
And yet that feels a little uncomfortable at the same time.
Yes, and yet it feels a little uncomfortable. And so at one time, it's like it kind of calls you inwardly. But at the exact same time, it's almost like a little performance of yourself in the space.
There's both something profound and something funhouse about it.
Absolutely. There is absolutely something funhouse to it. And the color contributes to that. But there is something profound when you let yourself just be. It has a haunting quality.
Medvedev says she hopes that moments like these become a definitive part of experiencing Boston.
Well, I hope it becomes an icon for Boston. That's my really great hope. I hope that it's a piece that people return to over and over again over the decades going forward, and it becomes a touchstone for an experience.
Jill Medvedow is the director of the ICA. Love is Calling, the largest of contemporary artists, Yayoi Kusama's Infinity Mirror Rooms, is now in the ICA's permanent collection. And though it's temporarily closed, Medvedow tells WBUR that when the exhibit reopens, it'll be at a reduced capacity and with monitored entry. Stay with us. There's more ahead after a short break. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is a Memorial Day edition of Radio Boston. Welcome back to this Memorial Day edition of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this hour we are revisiting conversations about people and places we miss. We've heard about the heroic loss at sea during the blizzard of 1978. We heard about cultural institutions like Club Passim and the ICA. And now, places of food and comfort. Earlier this year, Haley House Bakery and Cafe in the heart of Nubian Square reopened after being closed for almost a year. It's now temporarily closed again, but it is offering takeout. And when it was closed for financial reasons, the community of Roxbury missed the social enterprise restaurant. Radio Boston's Paris Alston spoke with Callum Borchers in February about the reopening and what the cafe's all about.
So Haley House is a social enterprise, which means they're a business, but they have this mission of doing good and uplifting the community where they operate. So it was a really big deal when they closed because the community felt like it was losing a staple of who they are. And when they closed, the owners said they were taking a temporary hiatus to reevaluate its business model.
Ah, so were they able to do that? I mean, what did they do in the year that they were closed?
So in that time, a number of things happened. The cafe and bakery obviously closed, but they were still able to continue their catering service as well as a number of social services that they're known for offering. They also renovated the space, so they kind of improved its old space and made it fresh and shiny and added a lot of new sparkling touches. And they hired a woman named Misha Thomas as general manager for the bakery. And she, along with a number of other management and members of the staff, went through training in what's called open book management. And that's where they learned how to run a business like theirs. And when I sat down with Misha to talk more about that, she said that's an education that the cafe really needed.
Looking at past menus alone, I can see huge discrepancies on what they were charging, even for something like, you know, a cookie or coffee. The cost of goods were extremely out of whack. The labor levels were also extremely unbalanced for what the organization actually needed and what this cafe could sustain from a revenue point of view.
So how do you balance that with wanting to be this service in the community that is accessible for everyone, but you also got to make money?
Just getting everybody on the same page, from staff to you know, volunteers and folks that are over at the office too. It's like, hey, generating revenue means that we balance labor and cost of goods in this way. We communicate that to the customer and set expectations accordingly. The idea now is that we're able to, as much as we can, sustain ourselves and act as a positive model for other folks that are trying to run social enterprises as well. So we're still looking at training people from the neighborhood, training people and hiring people that have backgrounds of incarceration or have question marks on their quarry, training them up and giving them the skills so if they want to move forward in the restaurant industry, they can. If they want to move forward as an entrepreneur, they can, given what they learn here.
And just to note, Callum, that CORI stands for Criminal Offender Record Information, which, of course, is a record of an individual's criminal history.
So she mentioned that maybe the menu's changing, maybe some of the pricing had to change, there's some new staff. What else is changing at Haley House?
So as I mentioned earlier, the space changed. So they have this new, fresh space. And it was my first time at Haley House, actually. So I wasn't really familiar with what it looked like before and wasn't able to do the compare and contrast. But I did meet some people who were able to do that. And I spoke with a woman named Taishia Smith. She's actually an employee who was able to continue working at Haley House throughout its closing and renovation. And she's a fan of the new look.
It's more space, color-wise. I mean, it looks brighter because of, you know, the different color paint that they use. I mean, I like it. I mean, I still miss some of the art, you know, like the local art and stuff like that. Hopefully we'll bring that back. But I also like the black and white pitches.
So that local art that she's talking about was actually part of a program that Haley House did called Art is Life Itself. And that's where they would showcase local artists and they would put up these really colorful, vibrant pieces of art that really uplifted the local art community. And General Manager Misha Thomas says that's something she's talking to other management about bringing back. They also changed the menu. So some people were a little bit worried, oh, like, is my favorite menu item going to be on there? And I spoke to a man who said some of the things did have to get removed because we can't get everybody everything they want. Like, it was really nice for us to try to do this, but we're gonna have to scale this back a little bit. So
I hear the mac and cheese was important, though.
The mac and cheese was really important to keep, and as Misha said, you might not get the same portion of mac and cheese that you once did, but it's still gonna be one of the best mac and cheeses you've ever had. And they have new additions like chicken and waffles with maple syrup and chimichurri sauce, something that the chef calls an emotion. Everything on the menu kind of has a big influence from the African Latinx diaspora, which is something that reflects the diversity up in the neighborhood.
I see. So how does Haley House fit into that neighborhood then? Because gentrification is such an important topic in Boston. Mm-hmm. Nubian Square, the former Dudley Square, is not immune to that. How does the new Haley House fit into that trend?
Yeah, that's a great point, Callum. And that's something that was definitely a concern for Haley House because they wanted to stay relevant even in the midst of a changing neighborhood, but they also had to stay true to their mission. That's something that they really wanted to do even as they embraced a new identity. And so that meant continuing to uplift the neighborhood, continuing to hire people who have barriers to success, hire people who are from their neighborhood. I met a couple named Phyllis and William Lewis. They had grew up in the South End and they live in Medford now, but they frequented Haley House for years and they were really glad that it reopened.
It still has the feel of a place that we can come to and still, you know, with the diversity, but still, you know, we can still commune with our people and still have diversity. I think it's a good thing.
I have to agree. As far as the gentrification of the area, that's happening everywhere. So you either got to get with it or, you know, move on. So I'm with it, I guess.
Phyllis and William Lewis there, speaking with Radio Boston's Paris Alston in February about Haley House in Nubian Square. And I should note that during the COVID-19 crisis, Haley House is closed for in-person dining, but is offering takeout at the cafe Thursday through Saturday. And while we're on the topic of good food and community, we want to revisit a classic television moment about coming together as a family for dinner.
Anthony Martinetti lives in Boston, on Prince Street, in the Italian North End.
Those are, of course, the opening seconds of the now iconic Wednesday is Prince Spaghetti Day TV ad from 1969.
We marked the Ad's 50th anniversary here on Radio Boston in October of last year by sending our own Jamie Bologna back to the winding North End streets featured in the commercial with a now all grown up Anthony Martinetti.
Anthony Martinetti.
Where are we right now, Anthony?
More Charter Street in the North End.
Oh, my God.
How are you?
How are you, buddy?
I love you.
Let me show how you been.
Good, good.
Still smoking, man? Come on.
This is what it's like to walk the streets of the North End with Anthony Martinetti.
I know. My son's 15. I started late.
Oh, my God. 15.
Although he won't admit it, he's a bit of a local legend here, still recognized in his old neighborhood.
I remember getting letters. People say they named their kids after me, Anthony, and people saying, you know, my name's Anthony, and people, they stretch it out when they say it. It's the same way they do it, you know, in the ad. They sing it.
Did that bother you? Did that bug you?
No, it didn't bother me. I was like, you know, that's nice. You know, a lot of people, like it says, I named my son after you. That's an honor.
But let me back up, because maybe you've never seen the ad that made Anthony a household name. The commercial ran nationally on television for 13 years, starting in the fall of 1969, and it was produced by the then Lowell-based Prince Pasta Company. Now you can find it on YouTube. It opens with Mary Fiumara leaning out of a second-story window on Powers Court, yelling, "Anth..." Well, I could do an impression of it or play the clip for you, but maybe I'll have Jim Botticelli, he's the author of the book Dirty Old Boston, Four Decades of a City in Transition, give us a taste.
Anthony! The minute you say Anthony, they know what you're talking about. Especially if you say it in that tone. Anthony! If you say it in that tone of voice, they know exactly what you're talking about.
You're talking about Prince and pasta. But in 1969, pasta was not really part of the mainstream. Italian food for many Americans was SpaghettiOs and Chef Boyardee. Here's how Paula Taylor, she runs the Food and History Culture Tour Off the Eaten Path, describes the commercial.
It's a little bit voyeuristic in some ways when you see Anthony Martinetti running through the streets. But then it flips to being back in the kitchen where you see his mother making the pasta and the family gathering at the table, and it kind of shoots back and forth. It's really like a documentary in some ways.
And it wasn't only spaghetti. James Pasto, co-founder of the North End Historical Society, says the commercial put people just like him into the center of American life for the first time.
It was exciting. It was exciting to see us on TV showing Italian Americans on TV, which we weren't used to seeing. It was kind of unworldly, surreal almost, because we were on the map of America.
So the ad had a big impact. I'll tell you more about that in a minute. But let's hear Anthony again talking about filming it.
And then the scene where at the end of the commercial where I come through the door, they says, okay, stand outside the door. When we say action, come in. So they says, no, listen, you've been running all this way. You got to act like you're tired. I wasn't an actor. I didn't know how to act tired. One of the guys that I was with, he made me run 15 times up and down the stairs until I got tired.
Up and down.
So when I opened that door, I was really exhausted. I wasn't acting. I was tired.
And the commercial ends like this. Everyone gathered at the table. The last one to arrive is Anthony, out of breath.
And as every family in the North End of Boston will tell you, Wednesday is Prince Spaghetti Day.
So I asked Anthony, how did this whole thing come about? How did a 12-year-old kid born in Italy come to star in an American national TV commercial? Turns out, ad men and TV producers walking around the North End were just about as out of place as pasta was in the American diet.
You can tell they didn't live around here, the people. So they asked us for directions.
What do you mean you could tell they didn't live around here?
Well, the way they were dressed, the way they looked, they had long hair. Back in those days, they were, you know, our parents always told us, stay away from the hippies, they're going to kidnap you. You can tell the way they talk, the way they you know, dress, the way they look, you can tell they didn't live around it. Plus, we didn't even recognize them. Usually, in those days, you know everybody from the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So my friends were, like, mean to them, like, get out of here before it gets dark out, you know, typical punks. I just gave them directions. And then about a few weeks later, they asked me if I wanted to be on TV.
It was iconic.
Peter Saronic is a former Boston ad man and now at Emerson College.
I mean, it was sort of a standing joke that Wednesday's a Prince Spaghetti Day, and it's probably part of our sort of Boston thing, you know.
So the ad was meant to sell pasta, and it did. but it also sold an idea of family, of Boston, and of Italian Americans. And in today's terms, it went viral. Of course, a lot has changed in the North End since 1969. Back then, Boston was Balkanized, and the North End was mostly Jewish and Italian immigrants. It was walled off from the rest of the city by the looming green central artery. Here's tour guide Paula Taylor.
It was fishmongers, greengrocers, butchers with rabbits hanging in the windows, chickens in the back, lots of people hanging out in the streets. I feel like the neighborhood felt more colorful. There was lots of awnings on the storefronts. You don't see that as much anymore.
Among the many changes, Anthony himself is now in his 60s and doesn't live there anymore. Lifelong North End resident Mary Fumata, who played Anthony's TV mother, died in 2016. And Prince Pasta is no more. It's no longer made in New England, and it's now just one of dozens of brands owned by a Madrid-based food conglomerate. But still today, if you stroll down Hanover Street, you'll get a distinctly Italian-American experience. You'll see pastry shops, markets, and delivery trucks double parked. And you'll also see a more diverse group of residents and business professionals in yoga gear, maybe even walking their dogs. You'll see a Chinese takeout place and a Bank of America. James Pasto of the North End Historical Society says the commercial takes us all back to an older idea of the North End, as it once might have been when it was a stopping place for new Italian immigrants.
I mean, I think the nostalgia is there now. It helped create something to look back towards, the North End of the 60s. It recreated the Italian-American neighborhood, in a sense.
So getting back to its impact, let's hear from Marguerite Bonapane. She's the author of 6 editions of the North End Italian Cookbook.
You know, it made people aware of pasta.
She knows a thing or two about the North End and about pasta. She's a former restaurant chef and owner, and she taught cooking classes there for more than 3 decades.
It is a good thing, which we took for granted. And there's no other food in the world better than a plate of spaghetti with sauce.
When she says taken for granted, she means for Italian-American families, pasta and tomato sauce was sort of a daily food. But for a lot of Americans, it was still exotic, maybe even foreign. Not anymore. Americans consume almost 6 billion pounds of pasta a year, or about 20 pounds per person. Although if you ask me, that seems a little low. But maybe the Wednesday is Prince Spaghetti Day tagline had something to do with that. Again, tour guide Paula Taylor.
People recognize it. What surprised me is people from other states recognize it. Having this tour, I get people on my tour from like rural areas of the country, urban areas. People from Texas tell me they love that commercial and that they were amazed it happened in the North End. I think in some ways that commercial also put the North End on the map as America's Little Italy.
For Marguerite Bonapane, now that the North End is very much on the map, it's also changed. And not just the neighborhood, but the culture.
No, those days are gone. As far as I know, it'll never be the same unless everybody gets smart and slows down.
Anthony Martignetti agrees.
Now it's like everybody's rushing to be someplace. Relax. You know, sit down, enjoy your family. They don't last forever. I miss those days. Sunday afternoons, my brothers, my sister. So every weekend, the whole family, it was a family gathering. Now it's like you're lucky if you see your family once a year.
Why do you think that is?
Times have changed. I mean, things are so expensive now. People need to work 2 jobs. Back in those days, you paid $50, $60 a month.
For rent.
Now you're paying $3,000. Who can afford $3,000 a month? Not really.
So maybe you're feeling how I'm feeling right now. A little nostalgic for a simpler time. Maybe sad that there never seems to be enough time in the day to do all the things you want to do or see your family. And for me, this is the strength of the ad 50 years later. Because I get it. At the end of the day, it's just a television ad. It's trying to sell a box of dried pasta. But it's also selling an idea. The idea of a family sitting at a table together for dinner. That simple idea changed how a lot of Americans viewed Italian food and their Italian-American neighbors. And now, 50 years after it first aired, the commercial endures as a way to talk about where we've been and what's changed. Again, Jim Botticelli, author of Dirty Old Boston.
Yeah, I guess we've made that Prince Pasta ad sort of a metaphor for the times we lived in versus the times we live in.
And even though it's the late Mary Fumara who leans out that second-story window in the North End to call Anthony, she's really calling us all to the table.
Anthony! Anthony!
Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna. As Jamie reminds us there, so many of us now long for a return to the big dinner table, coming together with extended family and friends, sharing a meal. A bit of nostalgia for a slower, simpler time. So as you pause today for Memorial Day, I hope you find comfort in honoring those you miss and the things you miss doing. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.